9/11 Millennialism, A New Pearl Harbor. The British occultist Aleister Crowley's parents came from a strict religious background. The evangelical preacher Tom Bond Bishop was his uncle. His grandfather was a Quaker who had amassed a fortune as the owner of a brewery that produced Crowley Ale. Doctors William Pancoast and J. Marion Sims of Jefferson Medical College performed the first reported artificial insemination with donor semen on the wife of a Quaker merchant in the late 1800s. Stories circulated that the anonymous donor was a relation of the crowned heads. Occultist Charles Webster Leadbeater resigned from the Theosophical Society in 1906 because he oversaw the masturbation of boys under his care. Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence and Avondale, known as Prince Eddie, was a potential eugenics donor when he entered puberty. Before the Tavistock Clinic was founded in 1920, rent boy posh sauna baths attracted the chiefs of the London eugenics movement. When Aleister Crowley was born, on October 12, 1875, in Warwickshire, England, his father Edward, a reformed Quaker and petty lay minister, joined an English Protestant fundamentalist sect known as the Plymouth Brethren. It was Aleister Crowley's mother Emily, an almost tyrannically devout woman, who had given the boy the title of the Beast after she guessed she had spawned a mischief maker. According to Crowley, who in childhood inflicted cruelty to animals, he identified with that name and for the rest of his life viewed himself as the Beast of the Apocalypse, the enemy of Christianity. Although Crowley claimed to have liberated himself from the Judeo-Christian religion he so detested, in reality he became a collaborator to it. By professing to be the Great Beast 666, he mindlessly shackled himself to apocalyptic motifs and the apocalyptic viewpoint connected to Jesus' return. Crowley's biographers often noted how he loved to bend the rules. Yet, the word he would most often break was his own law of thelema. He was a man who never commanded his own free will, instead he robotically played out the role of an apocalyptic oddball orchestrated for him by others before he was born. His eerie temptation on the highest peak was a 1905 Himalayan mountaineering accident. The British, CIS, intelligence agent Aleister Crowley was a natural actor. He was one of the chief Satanists of the 20th century. But he was also an easy target for apocalyptic literature that developed in post-exilic Jewish social groups, and was central to the earliest millennialist Christians. The 666 Beast revolved around the symbols pertaining to the end of the world, eschatology, and signs of the biblical apocalypse or St. John's Revelation. The firstborn of the Illuminati was created higher than man, not of sexual intimacy, but from noble donors of eugenics. He was the lost prince, born of a sleeping virgin. Science had amazingly shaped him and extended his lifespan. But he could no longer carry on. His physical strength and intellectual functioning deteriorated. The Horus incarnation had lost his facility to think and to reason, his bones became brittle. The scientists knew the end of life was imminent. He was frozen, like a pig, for as long as possible, in suspended animation. In a climax of pomp and ceremony, the Beast was relieved of his decision-making responsibility. The guard-changing decree would be remembered behind the panic of a new Pearl Harbor. Doctors conducted human trials of suspended animation. Scientists had previously performed the procedure on pigs with a 90% success rate. Their physical and mental functioning was unharmed. After we did those experiments, the definition of dead changed, surgeon Peter Rhee at the University of Arizona in Tucson, who led the pig experiment, told the New Scientist. Every day at work I declare people dead. They have no signs of life, no heartbeat, no brain activity. I sign a piece of paper knowing in my heart that they are not actually dead. I could, right then and there, suspend them. But I have to put them in a body bag. It's frustrating to know there's a solution. Olga Hazan, How to Freeze People and Bring Them Back to Life, The Atlantic, May 27th, 2014. With regard to apocalyptic motifs, astronomers knew that on March 10, 1982, the planets Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Pluto, and Saturn would be on the same side of the Sun, within a 95-degree wide interval, in what scientists call a grand alignment. The grand alignment of 1982 signified the dawning of the age of Aquarius, or the end of a zodiacal era, age of Pisces, and the period of transition to the third millennium. In 1973, the fated Kohoutek comet of the century arrived at Christmas. In 1974, the astrophysicists John Gribben and Stephen Plojman played on somber sentiments and predicted in their book, The Jupiter Effect, that when the planets lined up on one side of the Sun, the Earth would be caught in the middle of a huge gravitational pull between the Sun and the planets, particularly the giant planet Jupiter. These cosmic forces, they claimed, could cause massive catastrophes, including a great earthquake in California. When the 1982 Grand Alignment happened as predicted, Los Angeles was not destroyed. An earthquake occurred in 1986 in California. Stark historic coincidences took place in other parts of the world. The Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev died in 1982. A few years after that, the most horrifying nuclear accident occurred at Chernobyl, just as Comet Halley was approaching at its brightest, in April 1986. Halley is the only short-period comet clearly visible to the naked eye. In 1705, Edmund Halley correctly predicted the comet's 76-year period. However, the 1986 approach of Halley's comet proved to be the darkest yet observed by Earth watchers. Many people never saw it. When European spacecraft examined dust particles from Halley's comet, they came across some of the most organic-rich matter ever to be measured in the solar system. The comet's organic molecular proportions were nearly equivalent to the organic matter found in humans. Underpinning the prediction of atomic furnace smoke triggered by a burning star or apocalyptic comet falling from the sky, Chernobyl is the Russian name for Wormwood, German, Vermuth. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became Wormwood, and many men died of the waters, because they were made bitter. Revelation 8:10-11, the smoke of a great furnace is depicted. Revelation 9:2. According to Belarus national statistics, the full cost of the April 1986 Chernobyl reactor meltdown in the Ukraine could top a quarter of a million cancer afflictions, due to waters and ecosystems bitterly contaminated from more radioactive fallout than the first atomic bombings. The Berlin Wall was dismantled within a few years. As if an alignment could draw together the coming millennium, the Soviet Union quickly collapsed in 1991. As Elikhau reported in Astrology and the Third Reich, Urania's Children, 1984, during World War II, the Swiss astrologer Karl Kraft was appointed to show that the prophecies of Nostradamus boded well for Hitler. When Kraft forecast a Nazi defeat, he was incarcerated, contracted typhus, and died in 1945 en route to the Buchenwald concentration camp. In the summer of 1994, Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 crashed into the southern hemisphere of Jupiter. It was the first comet ever found to be orbiting a planet. Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker and David Levy discovered it in March 1993. Studies of the comet soon revealed that, unlike all other comets seen before, it was orbiting Jupiter rather than the Sun. Its orbit was very loosely bound and highly eccentric, with a period of about 2 years. Tracing back the comet's motion indicated that it had been orbiting Jupiter for some time. In all probability, the comet strayed from a solar orbit during the 1970s, although its capture may have occurred as early as the 1960s. There was even guesswork that Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 might have fallen into Jupiter's reach during early stages of the 1982 Grand Alignment. Minor gravitational disturbances caused by the outer planets can alter a comet's orbit, steering it closer to the inner solar system. Some type of Jupiter effect had evidently disrupted the orbit of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, but no archived images of it dating back earlier than 1993 could be found. Comet Hale-Bopp also turned up at about that time. It was probably the most widely observed comet of the 20th century, and one of the brightest seen for many decades. Two independent observers, Alan Hale and Thomas Bopp, discovered Comet Hale-Bopp on July 23, 1995, at a great distance from the Sun, inspiring hopes that the comet would become very brilliant when it came close to the Sun. The luminosities of comets are difficult to prefigure with exactness, but Hale-Bopp matched or exceeded most calculations for its brightness when it passed the Sun on April 1, 1997. The comet was dubbed the Great Comet of 1997. It was visible to the naked eye for a full 18 months, twice as long as the previous title holder, the Great Comet of 1811. The perihelion of Hale-Bopp took place on April Fool's Day, or All Fool's Day, an occasion celebrated by hoaxes and practical jokes. It also whipped up an excessive degree of alarm regarding comet rumors, which stirred a reappearance of the Death Pact cult. Rumors that an alien spacecraft was flying behind the comet set off a mass suicide among followers of a fanatic UFO cult named Heaven's Gate. The sect resembled a depressing medieval order. Six of the male members voluntarily underwent castration. On March 26, 1997, the group's religious leader Marshall Applewhite, and 38 others were found dead from ingestion of phenobarbital, in Rancho Santa Fe, California. For a few months prior to their suicides, some of the members worked for a software company that developed computer-based source code for the U.S. Army. A 1993 raid by the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and a subsequent siege by the FBI ended with the burning of the Branch Davidian religious group ranch outside of Waco, Texas. 76 people, together with the group's leader David Korsh, born Vernon Wayne Howell, and many children were found dead after the fire. A cult of death agreement was set in motion in 1978 when over 900 people at the Jonestown communal village in the jungle of Northwest Guyana died in a mass suicide, cyanide poisoning. The dead were members of a religious institute known as the People's Temple, headed by the Reverend Jim Jones. U.S. Congressman Leo J. Ryan and four members of his team were shot and killed. As the great year 2000 quickly approached, people the world over expressed a curious excitement for new millennialism. The beast was also referred to. Christian theologians used the word chiliasm to describe a time of anticipation. It was acknowledged by the New York Times that the key ingredients for life perhaps came from outer space. Even so, the public lagged behind and was still inadequately informed. Tell me, did you fall for a shooting star? Train, Drops of Jupiter, 2001. In 1555, the French physician and astrologer Nostradamus, Michel de Nostradamus, had made his most exacting doomsday prediction in the apocalyptic visions he called the Centuries, the year 1999, 7 months, from the sky there will come the great king of terror to reawaken the great king of the Mongols. During Nostradamus' life, the Inquisition threatened him for allegedly criticizing the Roman Catholic Church. He had to flee southern France for 2 years. In modern times, his prophecy became a trendy cliché for the 21st century. It was widely rumored that the start of the third millennium, give or take several months, would initiate a very disturbing phase for civilization. But Jacqueline Allemand, director of the Nostradamus Museum in the southern French town of Salon de Provence, where Nostradamus lived in the 1550s, said that he could simply have been referring to the very last solar eclipse of the second millennium, which it may have been possible to foresee. Adam Sage, King of Terror, may be. Just a solar eclipse, the Observer News Service, July 2, 1999. The final solar eclipse of the 20th century transpired on August 11, 1999. The 11th of August falls within Nostradamus' seventh month, according to readings of the Julian calendar. The 1999 eclipse of the Sun was probably the most viewed total solar eclipse in history. Organized eclipse watching parties were marked out in various locations along the path of totality. The flamboyant millennium celebrations that took place throughout the planet in the months that followed were declared an overwhelming success. As the third millennium came cruising in, a detailed analysis of the icy comet Linear abruptly breaking apart provided even more data to support the theory that ingredients for life on Earth arrived from outer space. The 2000 presidential election was the first in 112 years in which a president lost the popular vote but captured enough states to win the electoral vote. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost the election in 2016. The Supreme Court's moot decision in Bush v. Gore, issued in December 2000, effectively determined the outcome of the 2000 presidential election. The court noted that in many counties, machines did not register votes because of defects in punch card ballots, hanging chads. The presidential election of 2000 hinged on the outcome in Florida. First, the television network said that Vice President Al Gore had carried the state. Then, the state's election was considered too close to call. Then, the networks declared Texas Governor George W. Bush the winner. The presidential election was so close that it took 5 weeks to determine the winner. Vice President Al Gore carried the East and West Coasts and inland industrial cities, while Texas Governor George W. Bush won much of the Midwest and Plains, as well as the South. Gore gained a 500,000 more votes than Bush, but Gore lost the Electoral College when he lost Florida. Bush's official margin in Florida was by 537 votes. The disputed election of 2000, Digital History, 2013. Some liked the court's stance on balanced privileges in spite of political fallout. Others criticized the decision as insincere and politically opportunistic. The five majority justices had earlier and conversely granted great deference to state court decisions, and all were Republican appointees. Nobody knew the outcome of the recount, only that it threatened to make Al Gore president, and stopping it would guarantee Bush's victory. That is the environment in which five Republican-appointed justices essentially invented a one-time-only ruling to stop the recount. Jonathan Chait, "Yes, Bush v. Gore did steal the election," New York Magazine, June 25, 2012. In the meantime, frivolous pundits deemed year 2000 as the opening year of the 21st century and the third millennium. Yet, by conventional reading of the calendar, the year 2001 actually held that chief distinction. The spectacular science fiction film 2001, A Space Odyssey by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, released in 1968, put forward the civilized aim of a new century of space colonization. But instead of a cosmic odyssey, 2001 proved to be the outburst of a tyrannical conflict. On the morning of September 11, 2001, terrorists connected to Al-Qaeda, an international terrorist network, reportedly hijacked four U.S. commercial jet airliners. Commencing shortly after the 8 a.m. rush hour, they crashed two of the airliners into the World Trade Center in New York City. Both buildings collapsed and caused widespread damage to nearby structures. The terrorists reportedly collided a third aircraft into the Pentagon. The fourth plane apparently crashed into a field in Pennsylvania after passengers tried to retake control of the plane. Thousands of people died as a direct result of those brutal attacks. Shocked governments around the world offered condolences to America. Some conspiracy theorists referred to 9/11 as an inside job. Doomsayers recalled the biblical prophecy of the world's greatest city battered from above, "Fallen is Babylon the Great," and Nostradamus was again brought to mind. The start of the third millennium, give or take several months, shockingly suggested that a king of terror from the skies was Al-Qaeda, flying hijacked airliners into the world's tallest buildings. And the king of the Mongols was the newly revitalized face of jihadist terrorism. In fact, the thousand-year dawn of Nostradamus' critical solar eclipse began on 8/11, 1999 at 11:11 a.m. But who could have glimpsed a pattern of 8 a.m. 9/11? Veiled in those symbolic numbers? The U.S. response to the September 11th attacks was immediate and forceful. Over a period of just 3 days, Congress voted to spend $40 billion for recovery. Then, like his father in the period before the Persian Gulf War, George W. Bush organized an international coalition against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban government in Afghanistan that supported it. He persuaded Pakistan, which had been the main sponsor of Afghanistan's Taliban government, to support the United States diplomatically and logistically. On October 7, 2001, in retaliation for the September 11 attacks, AU.S. led coalition launched an attack against targets in Afghanistan, the beginning of what President Bush has promised would be a long campaign against terrorist groups and the states that support them. The American strategy in Afghanistan involved using American air power and ground targeting to support the Northern Alliance, the major indigenous force opposing the Taliban. Later, U.S. and British forces coordinated ground operations against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. September 11, 2001, Digital History, 2013. The war on terror forced the nation to toughen its national security. The federal government detained more than 1,000 people, mainly Arab and Muslim men suspected of having information about terrorism, following the horrifying events of September 11, 2001. These detainees were held without charges, and their names and whereabouts were largely kept secret. In the wake of the September 11 attacks, Congress enacted legislation that gave law enforcement agencies broader authority to wiretap suspects and to monitor online communication. Congress also expanded the government's authority to detain or deport aliens who associate with members of terrorist organizations. It also authorized greater intelligence sharing among the FBI, the CIA, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and local law enforcement agencies. President Bush responded to the attacks by proposing a cabinet-level Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security would help to prevent terrorist attacks within the United States, reduce the country's vulnerability to terrorism, and minimize the damage and recovery from attacks that do occur. The new department would be responsible for promoting border security, responding to chemical, biological, and radiological attacks, and utilizing information analysis. September 11, 2001, Digital History, 2013. The widely accepted, and here greatly summarized, account of what led up to and happened on September 11 is as follows: Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, helped recruit, inspire, train, and bankroll 19 hijackers to take over 4 U.S. domestic flights and crash them into high-value targets in New York City and Washington, D.C., as part of their ever-expanding holy war. They managed to just barely slip past all intelligence and security services, largely because of poor interagency communication. 2 hijacked planes hit the Twin Towers, 1 hit the Pentagon, and the 4th, which crashed in a field in rural Pennsylvania after passengers attacked their hijackers, was possibly intended for the U.S. Capitol building. The Twin Towers came down because jet fuel ignited incredibly hot fires inside that weakened their supports enough for their eventual collapse. Nearly 3,000 people died in New York and D.C. Joshua Norman, 9/11 Conspiracy Theories Won't Stop, CBS News, September 11, 2011. 9/11 conspiracy theories attribute the planning and execution of the September 11 attacks to parties other than, or in addition to, Al-Qaeda, or claim there was advance knowledge of the attacks among high-level government officials. Government investigations and independent scientific reviews have found no evidence for the theories. Proponents of these conspiracy theories claim there are inconsistencies in the official conclusions, or evidence which was either ignored or overlooked. Wikipedia.org. The most common conspiracy theory is that the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center were the result of a controlled demolition rather than structural failure. Another prominent belief is that a missile launched by elements from inside the U.S. government hit the Pentagon. A so-called live BBC News broadcast announced the collapse of Building 7 at the World Trade Center 23 minutes before it visibly collapsed on TV. The BBC is required by its royal charter to be unbiased and, if wrong, must correct its errors. In 2013, Tony Rook took the case to the UK court and won. Rook said, "If I pay my TV license fee, then I am supporting a group that supports and facilitates terrorism by spreading false information about terrorist acts." The BBC never credibly explained this error. Was it complicit in a 9/11 cover-up? It also said in 2007 that Building 7 did not fall at free fall speed. Our reporter Jane Standley was in New York on the day of the attacks, and like everyone who was there, has the events seared on her mind. I've spoken to her today and unsurprisingly, she doesn't remember minute by minute what she said or did like everybody else that day. She was trying to make sense of what she was seeing, what she was being told, and what was being told to her by colleagues in London who were monitoring feeds and wires services. We no longer have the original tapes of our 9/11 coverage, for reasons of cock-up, not conspiracy. So if someone has got a recording of our output, I'd love to get hold of it. We do have the tapes for our sister channel News 24, but they don't help clear up the issue one way or another. If we reported the building had collapsed before it had done so, it would have been an error no more than that. Richard Porter, part of the conspiracy. BBC, February 27, 2007. Larry Silverstein, the controller of Building 7, said in a PBS report on September 10, 2002, and they made that decision to pull and we watched the building collapse. The World Trade Center's basement allegedly contained vaults used to store gold and silver bullion. Building 7 housed then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. The 1993 bombing must have been part of the rationale for the command center, which overlooked the Twin Towers, a prime terrorist target. The Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 was a bomb attack by domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh on a federal building that killed 168 people. But on the day of the 9/11 attacks, Rudy Giuliani and his staff set up shop in a different headquarters, abandoning the special bunker designed precisely for such an event. WTC7.net. In 2014, a group calling itself Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth commemorated the 13th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center by displaying a massive digital advertisement in Times Square that purported to show World Trade Center 7, WTC7, falling in a controlled demolition. WTC7 came down in a classic controlled demolition, the advertisement claims. The government says fire brought it down, but anyone who watches the video can see otherwise. Behind those words, video of WTC7 falling repeats on a loop. Conspiracy theorists point to the fact that WTC7 housed both Secret Service and Central Intelligence Agency offices as proof that the United States government destroyed the building in order to hide evidence of its complicity in the events of 9/11. Scott Kaufman, Truthers commemorate 9/11 with Times Square ad showing WTC7 imploding on infinite loop, Raw Story, September 11, 2014. President George W. Bush classified 28 pages of the official report related to Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, citing national security concerns, and President Obama permitted the classification to continue. But U.S. Representative Walter Jones, RNC, had read the 28 pages and he was working to get them declassified. The families of the victims deserve to know all the facts concerning that tragic day, Jones said last December 2013 when he introduced the resolution. Furthermore, the information contained in the redacted pages is critical to our foreign policy moving forward and should thus be available to the American public. Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky called reading the withheld pages of the report disturbing and said, "I had to stop every two or three pages and rearrange my perception of history." Declassified on July 15, 2016, the 28 pages revealed a plot linking Saudi government officials, the Saudi royal family, suspected Saudi intelligence agents and 9/11 hijackers. The Saudi press accused the U.S. government of carrying out the 9/11 attacks. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the West initially asked Saudi Arabia to spread Wahhabism, an extreme form of Islam, to counter the then Soviet Union. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, an Army intelligence officer who worked closely with a military intelligence unit called Able Danger, alleged that Able Danger identified Mohammed Atta and three other future 9/11 hijackers more than a year before the attacks. Schaefer had his security clearance revoked in 2005. Congressional hearings on Able Danger were held in 2006. Deputy Secretary of Defense for Intelligence Stephen Cambone testified that a review failed to find any pre-9/11 references to Atta. However, according to Paul Sperry of the New York Post, FBI documents in 2014 revealed that at least three eyewitnesses spotted Mohammed Atta casing the security checkpoints at Boston's Logan Airport months before the 9/11 attacks. In 2013, former CIA agent John Kiriaka, who learned Arabic and oversaw the purging of Al-Qaeda's top speakers, was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for leaking classified intelligence, John Kiriaka, doing time like a spy, 2017. Kiriaka was first to blow the whistle on Washington's waterboarding torture program. Some reports said the White House anticipated that an attack was going to happen on September 11, but did little about it. Reports claimed that neoconservative White House policy bosses actually wanted something like a new Pearl Harbor to happen. It gave them the motivation they needed to launch the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, described by some observers as a radical plan for U.S. hawks to lead the world. The process of transformation, the plan said, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. Elite Republicans agreed that under normal circumstances it would take a long time for their plan to work. They thought it would be a long time because Americans would drag their feet and not rise up and rally to the great calling of a single superpower. But perhaps the U.S. military was not prepared to take on the world. According to the PNAC, a core mission for the transformed U.S. military is to fight and decisively win multiple, simultaneous major theater wars. Add post 9/11 traumas and confusion to the initial state of being unprepared for a transformed military and you get battle chaos and low morale. A core mission cannot be set in motion by misinformation and half-truths. The New Pearl Harbor, 2004, by David Ray Griffin casts serious doubt on the official story. False flag describes covert military or paramilitary operations designed to deceive in such a way that the operations appear as though they are being carried out by entities, groups, or nations other than those who really planned and executed them. In 1933, the Nazis allegedly set the Reichstag building on fire in order to blame it on the communists. The following conspiracy theory arguments were posted in 2012 by the News One staff. Right before the September 11 attacks, some fishy business happened within the stock market and insurance firms. An extraordinary amount of put options were placed on United Airlines and American Airlines stocks, the same airlines that were hijacked during the attacks. Many speculate that traders were tipped off about the attacks and profited from the tragedy. The Securities and Exchange Commission launched an insider trading investigation in which Osama bin Laden was a suspect after receiving information from at least one Wall Street firm. In the event that an airplane were to be hijacked, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, is prepared to send out fighter jets which can debilitate or shoot down an airplane. On September 11, 01, NORAD generals said they learned of the hijackings in time to scramble fighter jets. Some skeptics believe NORAD commanded defense systems to stand down because of their lack of presence during the attacks. Commercial airplanes' frames are constructed with a very light aluminum material in order to make it easier to fly. Theorists maintain that there is no possible way an airplane can do as much damage to the Twin Towers as it did. Theorists believe that missiles or explosives were used to ensure the buildings collapsed. After the September 11 attacks, the Loose Change documentary stated that all of the hijackers were in fact alive in other countries. Rather presumptuous since it is possible for two different people to have identical names. But they did raise a good point, how did the passports of the terrorists survive the explosion? In the aftermath of the attacks, passports and identification were found as evidence. Many skeptics question how identification made out of paper survived an explosion, which destroyed buildings. Initially, Osama bin Laden denied any responsibility or involvement with the attacks. Soon afterward, numerous tapes came out claiming that he took full responsibility on the attacks. Many skeptics believe that bin Laden was targeted because of his stakes in the stocks as well as former President George W. Bush's personal business ventures in the Middle East. Irving Kristol, the godfather of the U.S. neoconservative movement, was a disciple of Leon Trotsky. Ever since I can remember, I've been a neo-something, a neo-Marxist, a neo-Trotskyist, a neoliberal, a neoconservative, in religion a neo-Orthodox, even while I was a neo-Trotskyist and a neo-Marxist. I'm going to end up a neo, that's all, neo-nothing. Jeet here, National Post, June 7, 2003, drifting toward a neo-Nazi? So were other neo-cons, like Stephen Schwartz. To this day, Schwartz speaks of Trotsky affectionately as the old man and L.D., initials from Trotsky's birth name, Lev Davidovich Bronstein. To a great extent, I still consider myself to be one of the disciples of L.D., he admits, and he observes that in certain Washington circles, the ghost of Trotsky still hovers around. They were even saying that Paul Wolfowitz was the greatest Trotskyite of our times. Some of his associates called themselves Trotsky cons. Trotsky's most important contribution was the theory of permanent revolution. It occurs in two stages: first, as a capitalist pseudo-democracy that rapidly corrupts, collapses, and is substituted with a collectivist global workforce. The second stage is a grassroots never again permanent regulation that increasingly thwarts the resurgence of unchecked capitalism. The first stage of the LD theory seems almost fulfilled. In this stage, the Anglo-American capitalist elite, example central bankers corporations, literally try and take over the world. The New American Century Manifesto was just such a temptation for pushy globalist capitalists: take the world now or this chance may never come again. Therefore, the first stage is perhaps a designed to fail Trojan horse or sting operation. Various neocon Republicans were not in the loop, but gradually targeted for the concluding setup. Crystal elaborates, it is not a movement, as the conspiratorial critics would have it. Neoconservatism is what the late historian of Jacksonian America, Marvin Myers, called a persuasion, one that manifests itself over time, but erratically, and one whose meaning we clearly glimpse only in retrospect. Viewed in this way, one can say that the historical task and political purpose of neoconservatism would seem to be this: to convert the Republican Party, and American conservatism in general, against their respective wills, into a new kind of conservative politics suitable to governing a modern democracy. Aaron Russo was probably best known for producing the comedy classic Trading Places, 1983, and the Janis Joplin biopic The Rose, 1979. Before he died of bladder cancer in 2007, Russo also made statements about the global elite's dark vision for the future of humanity, in part due to revelations told to him by Nicholas Rockefeller. In an historic final interview, filmmaker and music promoter Aaron Russo goes in depth on the insider knowledge given to him by a member of the Rockefeller family. Russo was told prior to 9/11 of plans to stage terror attacks, invade foreign nations, and kickstart a high-tech police state control grid that would track the population's every move with implantable RFID microchips. Alex Jones, Aaron Russo leaves lasting warning about globalists' dark agenda, InfoWars, May 13, 2009. Russo said that Nicholas Rockefeller had attempted to recruit him into the Council on Foreign Relations with plans to stage terror attacks and invade foreign countries, and schemes to force RFID microchips on the population under a cashless control grid. On October 23, 2007, InfoWars talk show host Alex Jones said Aaron Russo privately informed him he'd been threatened and thought his cancer was the result of an attack. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand, or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Revelation 13:16-17, the Greek word used for mark in Revelation is haragma, described by Strong's Concordance as a scratch or an etching. Alex Jones was banned from social media sites in 2018. In his 2003 State of the Union address and before Congress, President George W. Bush claimed to have proof of Iraqi efforts to build nuclear weapons. But the International Atomic Energy Agency challenged evidence that President Bush had cited as proof that Saddam Hussein sought to revive his program to make nuclear weapons. The Bush-Cheney administration largely misinformed Americans about Saddam Hussein's so-called weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The most important evidence were documents purporting to show that Iraq had purchased uranium from Niger. These documents were also used to convince Congress to approve military action. However, these documents have since been proven to be forgeries. The Bush administration now concedes this fact. The FBI has been asked by Congress to investigate the source of these fake documents. The world knew on March 7 that the documents were fake, and this is one reason why the UN would not approve of the war. Dan Steinberg, Bush's best evidence against Iraq is fake, Renzi.com, March 29, 2003. When the mobile weapons labs were inserted into the draft of Secretary of State Colin Powell's United Nations speech, CIA Chief Tyler Drumheller strongly objected and believed that the error had been removed. He was shocked watching Powell's speech. "We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails," Colin Powell announced. Without the reference to the mobile weapons labs, there was no image of a threat. Sidney Blumenthal, "Bush knew Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction," Salon, September 6, 2007. According to Democrats Bob Furtick and Ted Koll, the invasion of Iraq was based on one of the biggest lies in history, that Iraq possessed WMDs that could be used against the United States. The clearest lie was Bush's January 2003 State of the Union address, when he declared, "Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa," a claim that had been thoroughly discredited by U.S. intelligence. Of course, this was just the tip of the iceberg of Bush's lies about Iraq. Although CIA Director George Tenet in 2002 had briefed President Bush in the Oval Office on top-secret intelligence that Saddam Hussein did not have active weapons of mass destruction, fabrications were deliberately made use of as reason for invasion. An out-and-out lie factory was keenly embraced by the U.S. news media. Scores of false statements were disseminated and supported by fake video reports, bogus aerial photos, and charade witness statements. Donald Trump thought that the same lie factory was drawn on to justify the invasion of Afghanistan. Angering Jim Acosta, Trump called fake news the enemy of the people. Would the news media lie about a pretext to invade Iraq, and not also lie about 9/11? Trump claimed that bombs were used on the World Trade Center. In April 2007, Senator John Kerry was questioned about the collapse of Building 7. He said that according to his data they did it in a controlled fashion. If 9/11 was an inside job, why would the U.S. government deliberately want to destroy the World Trade Center? Possibly because the biggest field office of the CIA was part of Building 7. The Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine New York station was cleaned out in the September 11 attack on the World Trade Center. The C.I.A.'s undercover New York station was in the 47-story building at 7, World Trade Center, one of the smaller office towers destroyed in the aftermath of the collapse of the Twin Towers that morning. All of the agency's employees at the site were safely evacuated soon after the hijacked planes hit the Twin Towers, the officials said. James Risen, secret CIA site in New York, was destroyed on September 11, The New York Times, November 4, 2001. The New York station was believed to have been the largest and most important CIA domestic station outside the Washington area. But United States intelligence officials emphasize that there is no evidence that the hijackers knew that the undercover station was in the World Trade Center complex. The primary field office of the CIA devoted much attention to global climate models. The 1990s was the warmest decade of the 20th century, and by some estimates the warmest decade of the past 1,000 years. CIA scientists believed man-made changes to the world's climate would promote dramatic swings in the weather, more floods, hurricanes and tornadoes. But how would global warming impact the biggest field office of the CIA? How would its demolition affect New York City? Klaus Jacob, senior research scientist at the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, predicted an 8-foot coastal storm surge, instead of every 50 years, It could happen every 5 years, and that's not good for a city that claims to be the world financial capital to see its financial infrastructure flooded every 5 years, and business interrupted, and all the things that go with it. Al Gore's 2006 film, An Inconvenient Truth, made the compelling case that cataclysmic global warming is real. By the 1990s, plans were made to relocate the key field office of the CIA from New York to higher ground. Denver, Colorado was an encouraging sight. In October 2012, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City. It was one of the worst hurricanes in United States history, responsible for 117 deaths. Hurricane Sandy caused $62 billion in damage, making it one of the nation's most expensive storms. While it was a Category 2 storm off the coast of the northeastern United States, the storm became the largest Atlantic hurricane on record as measured by diameter, with winds spanning 1,100 miles, 1,800 kilometers. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority said that the destruction caused by Hurricane Sandy was the worst disaster in the 108-year history of the New York City subway system. Seawater flooded the Ground Zero construction site. By then, however, the principal field office of the CIA had already been moved out of New York. GovernmentSecrets.com, June 2014. When Professor Klaus Jacob looks out over the World Trade Center site, he sees a potential disaster in the making. It's not the threat of more terrorism. Jacob worries that in the coming decades, whatever is built on the site will be vulnerable to the combination of rising seas and more intense storms aggravated by climate change. It may be hard to visualize the potential danger global warming could have on such a massive and resilient city as New York. But one major study shows that during a Class 3 hurricane, which is not even the most severe type of storm, Lower Manhattan would become its own island. The Financial District, City Hall, the World Trade Center site, all would be separated from the rest of New York by a mass of water. Degrees of Concern: Climate Change and New York City's Future, PRI, Public Radio International, 2011. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura visited Denver International Airport to explore some of its deep dark secrets. Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura is an American television series broadcast on True TV that premiered in December 2009. The airport has been plagued by conspiracy theories about its true purpose almost since the day construction crews broke ground on it in the mid-1990s. There are also a ton of conspiracy tales about the murals in Den, as well as the fact that it's supposedly shaped like a swastika. As you drive into the airport, you're greeted by a giant horse with glowing red eyes, and one of the terminals is decorated with a massive statue of Anubis, the ancient Egyptian god of death. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura thinks that Denver Airport sits above a giant network of tunnels that form a secret base camp for government officials in the event of apocalypse. Annalie Newitz, proof that Denver Airport is one of the most evil places on Earth, Gizmodo, June 2, 2011. The main terminal of the Denver International Airport, DIA, was designed by Fentress Bradburn Architects and completed in 1995. NORAD is not far from there. The Denver airport is allegedly filled to the brim with occult symbols everywhere you look. Brian Dunning, host of a podcast called Skeptoid, which examines unusual claims from a skeptical, science-based perspective, researched conspiracies about the Denver airport. He told Discovery News, "It's nearly impossible to summarize the vast number of ordinary events and objects at Denver International Airport that have been misinterpreted, twisted, and sensationalized into evidence for a Zionist New World Order Illuminati conspiracy to control and kill American citizens. There are facets of its planning, its design, its construction, its operational history, and even its artwork that conspiracy theorists point at as proof that we're all doomed." Benjamin Radford, World Domination from Denver Airport. Discovery, December 8, 2011. When the new American century was sketched out, the warning of climate change and its adverse effects to New York City allegedly inspired the CIA to relocate its main field office to the new Denver Airport, Raven Airport. However, The old site was not merely an empty office space that anyone could rent. Its vault was larger than a military base, and far more important to national security. Controlled demolition was the only way to hide traces of its sophisticated technology. Accordingly, U.S. officials would never be held accountable for the decision to pull the World Trade Center. From that day on, all U.S. airports would be subject to the utmost security so as not to draw attention to the protection of the new Denver Airport/CIA field office. But using it as a pretext to start a war and to bring to the forefront unwarranted security technologies were plausible violations of administrative power. There was nothing immoral about relocating the main field office of the CIA to higher ground. It was a noble cause, and probably hundreds of top CIA agents were actively involved. A decade of planning was required to transfer the systems that would be dramatically affected by changes in the global climate. But the 9/11 NORAD drill was disrupted and the evacuation process failed, causing thousands of deaths.